Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce, the podcast series that explores the fascinating and often overlooked history of fresh fruits and vegetables. Here are your hosts, Patrick Kelly and John Parr.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. Hello, Patrick. We got a fun one today.
I definitely think we got a fun one. It involves citrus, and you know, me being a little citrus, you know, my nickname, and, you know, being in the citrus world, we brought it all together. And not only did we bring it together, we thought it would be fun to bring the mafia into this, you know. So hopefully we don't get whacked over this, John, but...
I was going to say, those are two words you don't usually put together, fun and mafia, but I guess we can make an exception. Although Little Citrus could sound like a mafia name.
It could definitely sound like a mafia name, but start this episode outright with, you know, a quote from the, you know, this era, you know, the mafia sour origins, right? So, you know, the mafia emerged in an era that is still its heartland. It was developed where Sicily's wealth was concentrated in the dark green coastal strip among modern capitalists, export businesses based in the idyllic orange and lemon groves just outside Palermo. John Dickey, author of Cosa Nostra, A History of the Sicilian Mafia. So today, everyone, we are sharing the origin story of the mafia and how it relates to the history of fresh produce.
It's a really an amazing story, actually. And it's one that has been uncovered only in recent times, as we can all expect. I mean, mafia is obviously a very secretive society. So a lot of this stuff has only in recent decades been uncovered. So this is, I think, going to be a fascinating account that probably a lot of our listeners have not heard before. Where we're going to start today is we're going to start with the first basically account of a person being persecuted by a mafia ever. And we're going to tell that story so you can understand kind of the process of how the mafia worked at the very early stages. And then we're going to dissect why it happened, where it happened, why it involved the people it involved, and why it involved the product it involved. Let's dive into that story. So this story involves a Mr. Dr. Gaspare Galati. So you're going to hear a lot of Italian words today. It's going to be easier than some of the other languages we've taken a
step. Some of the Hawaiian words we had from some of the previous episodes, right?
Yeah, I'm feeling a little more confident this one. So
we'll see.
Feeling good. We'll see, exactly. So Galati, he was a surgeon. He was a family man. Kind of, you're well-respected by everyone in town. You know, picture this little village in the Mediterranean on the Sicilian island, going about his day-to-day. He had a brother-in-law who was in charge of a farm. And when his brother died in 1872 after a heart attack, he inherited this farm. And he died under I wouldn't say completely mysterious way. They suggest that the heart attack was a result of receiving a series of mysterious threatening letters. Okay, so just keep that in the back of mind. So he inherited this Fondo Riella, which was a 10-acre lemon and tangerine farm just outside Palermo. And Palermo is basically the big capital city of Sicily, right on the coast, on the port, the city of the island. Now, the farm's warden, so the guy that kind of oversee the day-to-day activities and kind of managed the farm, was a Benedetto Carollo, and he had been stealing more than his fair share of profits for years, it's been reported. So he may have not been very well educated, but he certainly had an attitude, and that was observed by Galati. He would basically swagger around this farm as if he owned the farm. And really, his objective by stealing the product was to really run the business into the ground so he could buy the farm for a negligible amount, because it was all about reputation. If people couldn't trust the product that you're selling, it's not too dissimilar today. You're going to lose business. If you lose your business, you know, let's say your ratings go down, you're going to get less offers to buy off that business, or the value of the business goes down. So Galati starts to try to lease this property to someone else, but Carollo makes it impossible. He starts harassing everybody that comes by to look at the farm and continues to tank the farm's reputation by stealing more of these pre-sold lemons off the trees. So Galati says, you know, I've had enough. Carollo, you're out. And he hires a replacement. Now, when this happens, Galati's close friends, who, you know, these guys had no reason to know anything about the farm business and lemon business, they just told him, you should probably take Carollo back. You know, I don't think this is a good idea. And Galati said, no, I'm done with him. We're going to move forward with somebody else. Well, okay. So July 2nd, 1874, the first new warden is shot several times in the back and dies in the hospital a few hours later. Not a good start. So Galati's son reports his suspicions that Carollo, so again, the original warden, was behind the murder to police. But the inspector ignores this lead and actually arrests two men instead that had absolutely no connection to the victim. And then, you know, luckily for those two people that were incorrectly arrested, they ended up getting released because there was no evidence against them. But Galanti stands firm on his decision with Carollo. He has no interest in getting this guy back, so he hires another warden. And after this second hire, he now receives a series of letters which said he was wrong to sack, quote, a man of honor like Carollo, and to hire an abject spy instead. And in addition, these letters threatened that if he did not employ Carollo, he was going to meet the same end as his warden, only in a more barbarous manner. Galanti sensibly says, all right, I've got this letter, not just one letter, but seven letters like this, okay? Seven letters of these threatening natured messages. And he goes back to the police, and he's promised by police that Carollo and his associates are going to be arrested. But the inspector, who, mind you, was the inspector from the first encounter when he reported this, was really not that keen. So 3 weeks later, Carollo and his son are actually taken into custody, but after just 2 hours, they were released because there's nothing on file or evidence for them having to do with anything with that crime. And Galanti at this point was convinced that this inspector was in league with the criminals. Galanti is convinced that there's something going on here, and he starts to paint a picture of how this local, what we know today as mafia, worked. Okay, so this is what he starts to paint. There's a cosca, or a clan, or a family that's based in a neighboring village that's operating behind a facade of a religious organization. And so there's this priest, a former monk known as Father Rosario, who ran a small confraternity in the village, and that was called the Tertiaries of Saint Francis of Assisi. Father Rosario was not such a godly man in the respect that he had a record with as a police spy under this old Bourbon regime, which we'll get into, basically the ruling kingdom or royals of this island. And he was also a prison chaplain. And so he took advantage of that role to ferry messages from the inmates. And it's important to note, though, that Rosario was not the leader of this gang. The president of this religious facade and the mafia boss of Uditore was Antonino Jamona. And Jamona, a little background on him. So he was born into a desperately poor peasant family, which was really not too unusual on the island of Sicily. It was, and again, we'll get into this when we kind of dissect the Sicilian background, but lots of poverty, a lot of hardship on the islands for the people. So this Jamona started working his life as a laborer. And over that time, he rose to wealth and influence. That coincided with the revolutions that accompanied Sicily's integration eventually with the Italian nation. And by 1875, Jamona's 55 at this point, he was a man of status. So he owned property worth some 150,000 lira. So this guy, you know, he was a respected, well-to-do man of society. And Galanti actually knew Jamona because a number of Jamona's family members were actually clients of Galanti. Again, small islands, most people know each other, especially if they're living in the same general commune, right? So the Uditore mafia based their power on running protection rackets and the lemon groves. They would force landowners to accept their men as stewards, wardens, brokers, and their network of contacts with cart drivers, wholesalers, dockers could obviously either threaten a farm's produce or ensure its safe arrival at the market. And when in control of a fundo, the mafia could steal as much as they liked, either as a tax. So, you know, they say, okay, well, we're going to steal 20% of the fruit because that's our payment. Or they're going to drive the farm reputation into the ground and make it available to them to buy for a really low price. So they had ultimate control. Now, so Galanti has this picture. So he reports evidence of murder to the investigating magistrate. He says, I'm done with this inspector. I know he's probably in cahoots with these people that are causing trouble. After he does that, more threatening letters arrive. And he's given 1 week to replace his warden with a man of honor. And what does Galanti do? He says, nope. Still not doing it. Got to give it to Galanti, though. I don't think I would wait for that many threatening letters to Ben, but
it was like, you know, it's like when you receive those, sometimes you receive, I would say, letters from like these false attorneys sometimes that they're just trying to get these claims on you, and you just keep, you know, throwing them away and throwing them in the shredder. And then finally, all of a sudden you get served papers like you're like, oh, maybe I should have paid attention to something like that.
Yeah. Except here we're talking about dead bodies.
I'm just saying, I'm trying to relate something, John. Like, I'm just trying to relate something.
I know. I didn't think you were going to be able to relate to dead bodies, but it was close. It was close. So January 1875 rolls around, and the second new warden that Galati had employed is now shot in broad daylight. He's found lying between two rows of lemon trees with multiple bullets in his back. And Carollo and two former workers on the farm are arrested on suspicion again. And the warden is not dead. He's actually able to identify his attackers, but didn't initially respond to police questions. He kept it to himself. But as things started to initially look like he was going to die, like most people do, they want to kind of let go of their sins and tell the truth. He basically started to give his statements and said that the men who fired on him were indeed the three who had been arrested. Now, miraculously, the warden doesn't die. He actually recovers, and his boss, Galati, is actually taking care of him. And as the warden recovers, he actually visits Jamona, which, if you just recalled, he's the perceived leader of this gang, and he goes there to make peace. A little strange. And the warden ends up retracting his accusations of Jamona and Carollo, and then turn, they never faced any consequences for the attempted murder. So the perpetrator, again, was identified as the main Jamona, who, according to local authorities, was a pillar of the community. But again, the warden ended up retracting those statements, and we're going to go into why we think that happened. So Galati, at this point, says, you know, I can't do anything else. You know, the police are not listening. People are just keep getting shot that run my farm. I'm probably going to be next. So he picks up his family, flees to Naples, and Jamona takes over the farm. Now, it's likely, like I was going to say, these wardens were affiliated with the mafia themselves. Because why, again, it would be strange otherwise why this warden would go to Jamona to make peace. And that these wardens were actually being used in a war between feuding mafias. That is the first account of a mafia incident. And yeah, there's a lot to unpack there. A lot of whys. Why Sicily? Why farmers? Why citrus? And who exactly is this mafia and where do they come from?
Well, let's break it down. I mean, Sicily is, you know, the largest island in the Mediterranean, and its history is marked by the continuous foreign domination. So, you know, having been colonized by Greeks during the early antiquity, it was, you know, pretty much controlled by Romans, the Byzantine, the Arabs, the Normans, Spanish, and the French. So
everyone had their hands on it.
I was going to say everybody had their hands in the orange bowl, you know, as no cookie jar. It's the orange bowl, right? The death of Frederick II, you know, the king of Sicily from 1198, died in 1250. So that represents a turning point. So in the effort of all this to establish a modern centralized state in Sicily, Frederick II promulgated the Constitution of Melfi in 1231, which limited the jurisdictional power of princesses and barons and empowered local magistrates who were responsible only to the king. Okay. Started to change a little bit. So the princes and barons were responsible for civil justice. Remember, that was only to the king. While the king, through the appointment of local the magistrates who remained in charge for 1 year, were responsible for criminal justice. So they're almost kind of making their divine powers, John, yep. Right? They're trying to make it to where, you know,
he wants ultimate authority,
right? Who controls what authority? Now, with the death of Frederick II, a period of political instability happened, followed, which led to an increasing decentralization of power to feudal lords who de facto established a system in which the king delegated the political, administrative, fiscal, military, and judicial power to the feudal lord.
That's a lot of power. So that's basically the establishment of feudalism, right? So these guys have ultimate authority over whatever happens.
Sounds like some mafia stuff going on behind closed doors, right? So, you know, in 1799, Napoleon conquered Naples, forcing King Ferdinand and the court to flee to Sicily. Now, under protection, the British, obviously, under British guidance, Sicily tried to modernize their archaic system by forcing the king in 1812 to ratify a new constitution which abolished the feudal privileges and the primogeniture. So new constitution was really designed by the barons now at this point, John. So it was a defense against the crown, Ooh, a little rebellion happening. Okay, I see it happening already. Additionally, feudal law prevented noble landholders from disposing of their lands. This was a real disadvantage at a time when the prosperity induced by the British occupation was making, you know, very high speculations in land that is highly profitable. So, and by that, right, after the defeat of Napoleon in 1815, Ferdinand established the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies with Naples as its capital. So Sicily no longer had its own parliament.
Yeah, that's huge, because now they're just a little province. They no longer have that independence and that identity. They're just, again, part of a king that lives much further away than local.
I was going to say, living far, far away, right? Just like with the British and the, exactly, you know, the American colony. That
doesn't usually work out very well.
That normally doesn't. So the weak and distant governance of the Bourbons only increased the prevalence of insecurity, providing the barons with unrivaled domination over local affairs, which we all know what will happen next, right? So the period of 1816 through 1860 was marked by revolts and the spread of, this is a good one to say, brigandage, during which several feudal lords fled, delegating the responsibility for the large estates to Gebelotti, who acted as mediators between landowners and, oh my gosh, the proletariat. They got some good words, okay? So a lot of this started to happen, which is insane, because now you almost have a mediator involved in landowners and what they're responsible for. So from having been just simple tenants renting the land from landowners and, you know, subleasing to peasants, many of the Gebelotti became landowners following the auction of the feudal land after 1812. To maintain order and to avoid being plundered by these brigands, they hired their own private guards. Now we got private security, referred to as the Capieri. And the easiest way to hire a Capieri was to recruit him from the brigands. So this arrangement secured the estate against the attacks of the Capieri's former companions. So no difference that we've seen today, right? Our gangs were started, which was to protect the communities, because the police wouldn't go in certain communities with high crime rates. So the coalition between the Gebelotti, the Capieres, members of the Compagnia di Armi, a private militia hired by the Bourbon government to maintain order in the countryside. Ooh, hired to maintain order, John. Ooh, I don't know. I get it, but let's where it brings us. So the brigands triggered a system of corruption, though, and intimidation, such that landowners could not afford to hire the Capieri anymore. So it became the target of the brigands, and they had to pay to get back stolen goods and livestock, of course, right? It's yours, but you got to pay to get it back.
Yeah.
So after Italy annexed Sicily in 1860, it redistributed a large share of public and church land to private citizens. Geez, sounds like what happened, some things that happened in Hawaii too, right? This resulted in a huge increase in the number of small landowners, okay? And what this also did was the new government had neither the strength or means to effectively enforce private property rights to landowners. Once again, they had to resort to hiring private security to protect themselves from theft on their own lands. So, I mean, it's amazing to see what happened, you know, through this time period. But let's talk about the landlords and the tenants.
Yeah, that structure is also interesting. And before we dive into that, I mean, to your point where they didn't have the means to enforce any private property rights. I mean, I read during the research that I believe there was only 350 policemen on the entire island of Sicily once it was annexed by Italy. So you're talking very understaffed. And again, a society that's plagued by poverty, hunger, lack of law and order. And what are people going to do? They're going to steal to get by and to survive. So the environment has really become fertile land for something like the mafia to grow in. But how did this landlord-tenant structure look, and how are the inner workings of this lending itself to the expansion and growth of this criminalized group? The type of contracts that were signed between the landlord and tenants, or we'll call them the gabellotti, represented variations of the sharecropping contract. So a tenant was allowed to keep a percentage of the total output, but that share could go up or down depending on the quality of the grows. So obviously, if the grows were particularly high quality, the share would be less to the tenant and vice versa. And the landlord would provide the trees, the water, the fertilizers, and the tenant was simply responsible for farming the land and for soil preparation. And that contract between the landlord and tenant usually lasts between 6 and 8 years. There's a good reason for that, because that is generally the minimum number of years for a lemon grove to become fully productive. Okay, so you have about 6 to 8 years. Given the uncertainty associated with this kind of sharecropping agreement, over time it was replaced by a simple employment contract, which according to which landlord hired an employee on a fixed wage. And this employee would be referred to as a castaldo. And the castaldo was in charge of the lemon grove and of the workforce that permanently worked on the land. So besides the wage, the castaldo be allowed to live in a small house close to the landlord. He would have wood, access to vegetables and cereals cultivated on the land. And in some cases, after, you know, a good amount of experience, he could even attain the role of a legal representative of the landlord when citrus fruits were brought to the market. So this person would physically go to the market with product and represent the landlord. And that's obviously a, you know, again, more power. In addition, the workforce, like I mentioned, that was hired by the castaldo was also supervised by the castaldo. And that squad was usually of about 15 people, a respective amount of power in the hands of this new setup. Now, the key agents in the negotiations were the sensali, and these were brokers that connected the lemon producers, so the farms and landlords, with the exporters in the harbor, basically Palermo. Now, the direct transitions between the producer and the retailer were infrequent. Okay, very rarely did you have, you know, to some degree today still, right? I mean, you don't have a grower speaking directly to a supermarket. You have brokers in between. So the sensali and the landlords could negotiate the price together and the quantity when the quality of the fruits could be evaluated. So what we know is like a spot contract. Otherwise, they can negotiate the entire yield of the grove before the ripening season. So a future contract. Again, a lot of stuff that's not too dissimilar to today. Now, when this agreement was reached between the sensali and the landlords, a fruit was placed on top of the gate of the farm leading to the grove. And that signaled the end of a deal and that such a grove was protected by the mafia, which supposedly guaranteed the property and its fruits were free of damage. And that was critical because, again, if you made a deal, again, whether it be spot or future, you expect a certain quality. And with law being so loose and unreliable on this island, this indicated, at least to some level, that this was protected. And so because of that weak law, the mafiosi were often involved in the negotiations between the brokers and the producers, feeling that vacuum and lack of trust between all the different actors in this supply chain of Sicily. And the power of the mafia in the area of Palermo became particularly strong in the decade after the unification of Italy, which you described, Patrick, because after Italy, we heard that land ownership went up, a lot more smaller farms. And with a lot more smaller farms, it was folks that had less capital. And so they had to lean on anything they could to get protection. And that led to mafia getting involved in all aspects of production, from the simple appointment of the castaldo or the warden, right, that we heard in the first thing, to the choice of the workforce, the negotiations and the enforcement of contracts. So mafia had their hands in all these different things. And you can see the appeal and the understanding of why a lemon producer would want to engage with these sorts of people to ensure the success of their business.
And it makes sense. I mean, it really makes sense because, again, what are these landlords and tenants to do when their land is, I mean, it's pretty much being taken from them in a way, but it's like they have to rent it back to give more money to rent other land to get security. Like, it doesn't matter. Almost the landowner or the tenants are the ones that are in the most distress.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And well, I mean, where are you going to go? I mean, you can't.
Who are you
going to
call?
Police.
Oh, sorry. Almost had me there, you know. But
almost.
It's true.
So it's very understandable. But there's still a lingering question, or two questions. Who are the mafia? Where did they come from? Who are these people? Are they these just evil people in the background looking to for the enjoyment of killing people and sending threatening letters? And why on earth are lemons this ultimate product that everybody wants to grow and is looking to make a profit off of. So I think this is a great place to take a break. And when we come back, we are going to answer these steamy questions. So stay tuned.
JGLC, the place to be, a third-generation, family-owned and operated asset-based company. Throughout their 60 years in business, integrity, reliability, and loyalty to their customers has remained their top priority. JGLC guarantees 24/7 communication with your personal logistics coordinator. They offer competitive pricing without sacrificing services. They operate throughout the United States and Canada. JGLC's customers count on them for dependability and dedication carried out on every order, every time. 60 years of service for all your trucking needs. Visit them at jglc.com for your custom quote.
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the History of Fresh Produce. And we are still talking everything mafia, Sicilian mafia, and citrus. We left before the break asking a few questions. Who are the mafia and why citrus? So I think, Patrick, we're going to start off with exploring a little bit more of where this word mafia comes from and who exactly were these people. As you kind of described at the beginning, Patrick, the Sicilian island was in many different hands, and for good reason. It was strategically placed into the middle of the Mediterranean. It was also like the breadbasket of many of these empires. It's very rich and fertile land. It's a volcanic island, dormant volcanic islands, historically for wheat and grapes and olives and all these things. And so one of these societies that were there were the Arabs. And some have suggested that the word of mafioso, consequently mafia, is found in the Arab language, where the word marfut used to mean swindler or cheater. But if we really want to look at more of the cultural origins of this word in the place of where this originated in Italy, or more specifically Sicily, we want to look at what that translates into. And the word mafia did not really have a negative connotation, but was simply characterizing somebody who was proud and courageous. In fact, in the period before the unification of Italy, when the proto-mafia was developed, a mafioso was a man who had gained the respect of the local population by standing up against the brigands, you know, the thieves, and the malicious crimes of the campieri, who are basically the guards and militia of the Bourbon people, which again were the kingdom that was ruling over Sicily, foreign power in their eyes. And this respect from the local population contributed to the legitimization of the mafioso. And in turn, they received a lot of support of the population, given that their crimes were justified. You know, they're taking care of people that were, in the eyes of the population, far worse than them. You know, they were killing off the
They were invaders. Taking care of business, man. That's what they were doing.
Exactly. They were taking care of business when nobody else would. And so basically everybody became directly or indirectly involved with the mafia, either by taking part in their activities or by covering and protecting those who committed those acts of, well, illegal acts. And it became a general practice to define a man who showed courage and resolution as a mafiosi. And the mafiosi, so who were these people? You know, they're not just, you know, coming out of nowhere. The mafiosi were recruited from pretty much the full spectrum of society. This included the gabellotti, it included peasants, it included doctors and politicians, and they typically performed their daily jobs as the integrated part of society while also undertaking these mafia activities. And so the latter half of the 19th century, it is actually known that the key mafia activity was the protection of businesses. That was their job. And for good reason, as we've been explaining, because there's that legal vacuum and void to protect the businesses, namely the agricultural businesses. That all said, it's very hard to identify the moment that the mafia arose, but we do know that they did thrive from offering protection to these lemon and orange producers, manipulating the market prices, from acting as intermediaries, like we said, between the producers and the exporters. And at the same time, these protection services would easily slip, as you can imagine, into extortion. Producers face the direct threat of violence from the mafia if they refuse to pay for protection money. You know, it's a slippery slope, obviously, if you're dealing with a private security force. And so, you know, you fast forward to decades ahead and to today, mafia has become a term used to label organized crime groups around the world. But there's really only one original mafia, and that's the Sicilian mafia. It's also important to note, so if you went up to a mafiosi, which I don't think you're going to easily just find somebody that's going to say, yeah, I'm part of the mafia, but they would not call themselves mafia. They identify their group, their gang, as Cosa Nostra, which means our thing. So that is what they call themselves. And the members of Cosa Nostra are known as men of honor. Those are the members. They're referred to as men of honor, and the organization is Cosa Nostra. Basically, their objective and their mission statement is as a sworn secret society that pursues power and money by cultivating the art of killing people and getting away with it. Pretty direct mission statement. And I think there's also a misinterpretation that there's this one big mafia boss that just rules over all the different mafiosi.
The kingpin.
The kingpin. But no, it's actually a collection of clans. So imagine, like, I think a lot of us probably seen Braveheart, you know, in Scotland, you had all the battling clans and stuff. So it's sort of like that, but they operate under this one brand. The brand Cosa Nostra. So you have family. So we've all heard, like, the family. No, your family, your family. So the clans, or they also call them families, they all operate under this one umbrella brand, Cosa Nostra. And they obviously, there's been infighting and power struggles between the clans. But that's the general structure of the Cosa Nostra. And their key tool or thing that really unites the clans is Omerta, which is the code of silence. So they do not speak to police. They do not, you know, this stuff is secret to the grave. And if you break the Omerta, you are pretty much guaranteed to be killed or
dun, dun, dun.
Taken off the map. So that is a bit of an understanding of who the mafia are. So it's not these, like, shady people that are just crime people looking for trouble initially. These were people that came from all forms of society that were looking to participate in a way to protect businesses and their society. And I'm not saying it's right, but that is where this all started. But why citrus? Yeah. Why on earth is citrus the product that really kicks off the power and the, I don't know, lack of a better word, the business of the mafia?
Well, and, you know, and why citrus in Sicily, right? I think crazy thing to go by. And the bitter orange, right? We say bitter. I mean, you know, oranges in itself, navel oranges, you know, can be bitter at times. Mm-hmm. It's the essence of it. When you drink orange juice, everyone to this day, when oranges are processed, they go through a debittering system to help it not be such a sour, just to give you a little fun fact. But the bitter orange was introduced in Sicily by the Arabs in the 10th century. The island's hot coastal plains, together with the exceptionally fertile soil containing a limestone base with heavy coatings of lava, were well suited for growing citrus fruits. You know, lemon trees, however, have a very poor tolerance for extreme climatic conditions. In order to grow and develop, they require temperatures between 13 and 30 degrees Celsius, where the average temp in Sicily is between 10 and 22 degrees Celsius. So by the 15th century, the prevalence of the sun-soaked trees brought the bay around Palermo a new nickname, and people began calling it Conca de Oro, or the shell of gold.
Ooh, that's a nice one. I like that.
Gold. I kind of like that.
Yeah,
because that's the lemon, right? The shell of gold. Yeah, or even then, you know,
that's a good brand name. The shell of gold.
Gold. That is. Who takes it first? Who knows? In the absence of a strong national and international demand, though, before the 19th century, lemons were mainly used for decorative purposes and for extracting essence. You know, like those Buddhist hands we see today.
Right.
They're, like, very unique. You can leave those on the back of your toilet, prick them every couple of days. They last, you know, right? And the aroma that they set off, you know, overly amazing. So Sicily in the 19th century was a leading producer of wheat, olive oil, wine, and above all, citrus fruit. So international demand for lemons started to increase from the late 1700s when lemons, and in particular, lemon juice, became a standard in preventative treatment against scurvy. Mm. So scientific support for the theory that consumption of citrus fruits cured scurvy was established by James Lind, a British naval officer and surgeon, and in the latter part of the 18th century when he lived. So the total surface area devoted to the citrus production went from 7,600 about hectares in 1853, increased to over 26,000 hectares in 1880. So the expansion was a direct result of the large returns associated with the demand for lemon. And if you remember, John, when I visited Boston over a year ago, we talked about the importations of lemons and oranges right into the Boston Harbor. So 1834, more than 400,000 cases of lemons were exported. By 1850, it was 750,000, and in the mid-1880s, an astonishing 2.5 million cases of Italian citrus fruits arrived in New York every year, most of them from Palermo. Wow. Yeah. So in 1860, it was calculated that Sicily's lemon groves were the most profitable ag land in Europe. Oh, man.
Well, there you go.
Speaking to our hearts, right? So, geez. Well, that's what we love to hear. Let's get that back up and going again, you know, here. The average annual cost, though, for a hectare of wheat is a lire 88, producing a profit of a lire 200. So the cost of 1,000 grape plants is 60 lire, providing a profit about, you know, a lire of 50. So you could see the difference. So finally, the cost of 1,000 lemon plants is 2,000 lire for a profit of 14,000 lire.
Well, there you go.
An extreme difference in profit from the wheat that they were producing to now the citrus. So the profit from a hectare of land cultivated, you know, with olives is almost 400 lire and lire 98 per hectoliter, but no costs were ever reported. So we couldn't even figure out the profit margin those when we were doing our research. So therefore, you know, the annual cost for 1,000 plants of lemons is almost 33 times larger, John, than the cost for 1,000 plant of grapes. But the profit is almost 35 times higher than the profit from olives. And olives were the second most profitable crop.
All right.
So in summary, the fixed and marginal cost of lemons, their production, were so much higher for lemon than any other crop, but so was the profitability. Like, that's insane. And even in today's world, we look at that, you know, sometimes depending on if you're a grower, you will replace certain crops on the hills where they're grown or flat land. You might take out a certain crop and actually replace it with a lemon crop. So efforts by producers made it possible to harvest lemons at least twice a year. In October, fruit they had in early maturation were collected, whereas fruit that matured more, they were then picked in February. They were left on the trees as long as possible in order to extend their supply or let it grow, just like we see today. The last fruit to go on the market were those maturing in the summertime, though they were considered of a lower quality. We see that now. Sometimes it's the summer quality, not imports, but actually in California, summer quality in the desert regions are a little bit different than in the coastal regions or the Central Valley regions. So in the wintertime, the fruits were placed in boxes and kept in underground storage rooms where the lemons could complete the maturation process. Now, fun fact again, Limonera, which is a Limonera company, which is a citrus grower collective group in Santa Paula, they actually still have basement where they keep all their storage of their lemons. So you could actually visit Limonera. They have a brand new packing house as well, John. But if you were to go to the old shed, they take you down to the basement and they still store lemons down there. But it's still to this day in 2024, we're still putting lemons in the basement to mature.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. And, you know, obviously what you described there with the lemons it starts to really paint a picture as to why this was so attractive to the landowners of Sicily, big potential for profits, and why it caught the eye of obviously mafia, because if the landowners are making profits, there's a way for them to extort and take profits from them as well. An important part that you caught on though was the cost for lemons. It was so much more expensive. And I think the important thing to understand, because a lot of listeners probably don't understand necessarily what the costs were back in the mid-1800s in Sicily for growing lemons, but there were huge fixed costs associated specifically with irrigation and the long time, obviously before trees matured, made these producers sensitive to predation. So lemons obviously are some of the most difficult and demanding to cultivate. They need that well-fertilized soil and a steady supply of water. So again, that irrigation being critical, protection from the wind and the temperatures. And all of that, of course, comes at a great infrastructural cost. These landowners are out so much money to do this. And then on top of just getting the stage set correctly, they need to then wait and essentially coddle these trees for 7 or 8 years before they even produce enough lemons to sell. So that's just setting the stage. And then, of course, you have the technology that they were using on these fields. And the technology equipment was also relatively easy and cheap to take. The lemon farmers, I mean, you can see it right there. It's kind of, you know, it doesn't take a rocket science to see it, but they were just ready to be exploited. I mean, you have high profits of a product. You have a weak rule of law. You have low level of interpersonal trust, you have a high level of local poverty. And so you have this product which takes a lot of capital to put into to grow, takes a long time for it to actually get to that point. And think about how easy it is to just take it. You just walk by a tree, start picking off some lemons.
Just grab it, yeah. Which people still do today.
Exactly. You can understand and appreciate why folks that lived on this particular island with the particular cultural history that they had in the environments that they were in, again, with immense poverty, immense struggle for the lower class, which made up the majority of the people on this island, they were resorting to the only thing that they could to get by, which was theft and crime, that the only option these landowners had was to hire people to protect them. And a lot of the people that protected them were those thieves and those criminals that were just trying to get by. And of course, if you were hiring thieves to basically police the thieves, that just opens up a whole potential of scenarios where you're going to potentially help your former friends and companions and, you know, push the limit with who's employing you, and, you know, you get the upper hand. So that is basically the story of how Mafia was born. We all have heard the stories about Mafia, more modern pop culture, more like 50s, obviously, and 60s, you know, The Godfather and all those things. But this is where it started. The Mafia would obviously go on to expand beyond the borders of Sicily, right? It would infiltrate societies of foreign countries, like right here in the U.S. Probably the U.S. is one of the biggest markets that they penetrated. And even more so, they even penetrated the fresh produce supply chains within the U.S. as well. And I think that's probably a fun episode we can do later on, because there's some very interesting stories from the first half of the 1900s where Mafia were actually involved in the produce industry in the U.S. But you see this also expands, not necessarily the Mafia in the exact kind of format it is, but we see it today too, Patrick, I think, with Mexico, right? The cartels there exploiting and extorting avocado growers, lime growers. Again, not necessarily born out of the exact same thing, but I think the general thread there is a weak government, a weak rule of law, and a desperation for protection, as well as an opportunity for these criminalized gangs and organized crime to make a profit. And so it's as simple as that at the end of the day.
Literally as simple as that. Again, who would have thought Mafia and citrus?
Yeah, yeah. So next time you think of lemons or lemon juice, think of Mafia.
Think of
or don't.
Or don't. Or don't. No. Or, you know, just think of a little citrus. Think about which
exactly. See, again, I'm telling you, that could easily, I mean, you've heard of the different nicknames. I think, was it like a lady, was it Ladybird? Or there's so many different names.
There's so many.
There's so many good nicknames. Mafia names out there. I do recommend listeners to read the book Cosa Nostra, which was the quote that Patrick took from at the beginning of this episode by John Dickey. It's a fabulous book that I read to help prepare for this episode. And it's, if you really want to get into like the full history of the Mafia from, again, the origins that we just described all the way through to today, that's your book. Fascinating read. So
hey, forget about it.
Anyway, that's all for us today. We hope you all learned a little bit more about the Mafia and have a deeper appreciation of Mafia. Again, if I could put those two words together, appreciation for Mafia. Anyway, until next time, it's goodbye for me, John Papp.
And myself, Patrick Kelly. Hey, we'll see you next time, everybody.